I will skip all introductions tonight. I think you'll be very happy. You all know probably, or some of you probably know who I am. My name is Paul Holden-Graeber, and I'm the Director of Public Programs here at the New York Public Library. And I imagine you all know Frank Rich. Great pleasure to have you here. Frank, I thought it was a good way of beginning to welcome you with a song by Les McCann, Eddie Harris, and Leroy Vinegar. I'll read you the lyrics that some of the people heard for a while here, our public. The president, he's got his war. Folks don't know just what it's for. Nobody gives us rhyme or reason. Have one doubt, they call it treason. We're chicken feathers, all without one nut. God damn it, trying to make it real compared to what? Sock it to me. So I'm
if only I'd thought of that.
Yeah, would have been. But I'm thinking this in a way speaks directly to your book. Real compared to what?
Well, real compared to a fiction. I think though it's interesting to hear that song again after all these years, because while many people, including me, have talked about various overlaps between the Vietnam period and this period, that's not one of them. I think the culture is much different now, and it's played out sort of differently. We don't have, we have YouTube instead of Les McCann, but...
True. We're much better off, right? But so
possibly.
We missed you, Frank, I think, for quite some time while you were writing your book. People were looking forward to you finishing the book so that they could read you again in the New York Times. And from the group of people who are here tonight, I think I'm not the only one who was missing you. But and I can already hear people applauding, so I know that you have a huge fan base here of Frank Rich fans tonight. What I'm wondering, though, is who is your book addressed to? Are you just speaking to the same old group of people, Democrats, liberals, like-minded people, everyone who likes Frank Rich, looks forward to reading Frank Rich, in a way, the same way Bush speaks to his audience, you speak to yours? I'm just quite curious who your book is addressed to, and I might even ask one more thing, who should be reading your book? So it's a double question. Who isn't already?
Well, I want everyone to read my book. The book I wrote was very deliberately not written as a sort of political treatise at all, and in some ways not really written like my column. It's written as a narrative, as a story. What I wanted to do was write a book that would be accessible to everyone, not dumbed down in any way, but that would be a page-turner, if you will, about a story that we all think we know, which is the story of how we went to war in Iraq, basically, after the events of 9/11. And so the tone of the book attempts to be judicious. There are strong opinions in it, but what I guess if I had an imaginary reader in mind, it was a reader possibly not even now, but in the future, though I hope obviously it works now, that would say, how was it, what did it look like to live, it, what was it like to live in a country which was so grievously attacked as we were on September 11th, 2001, and somehow be hoodwinked, in my view, into this detour into a war in a country that, as the President of the United States has only said in the past few weeks, had nothing to do with the attacks of 9/11. It's in a democracy where there's so much media available, there's so much opinion, there's so much news. That's quite an amazing feat to bring that off. One thing I've always felt about President Bush and the Bush administration is that they're not stupid. They're very, very clever. And
you've said that Bush is not stupid himself. He only
thinks we're stupid.
That's right.
Because he feels if he repeats something over and over again, we'll buy it. And to some extent, that worked in the special set of circumstances that followed September 11th.
So we've become stupid.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure I would make that generalization, But we were sold something. We're, this country, we're often sold many things that we have buyer's remorse about, you know, including products that have nothing to do with politics and cars and everything else. But I really wanted this book to work as a page turner, as a narrative, more than as an argument, although there's an argument contained within it. And I have to say the most gratifying response I've gotten in the very short time it's been out is that my brother has a son who is 13 or 14 who is not a reader, a suburban kid, not in New York, and who certainly has never read my column or the New York Times, and probably knows very little beyond the broadest headlines about anything involving the subject of this book, and picked it up because it was his uncle and started reading it and couldn't put it down. That to me was what I'm aiming for, not any particular political audience. Obviously people who have politics that overlap with mine is a first audience of sort for the book, but I'm hoping it's broader than that.
Okay, so your nephew didn't put it down.
Doesn't mean he liked it, but he couldn't put it down.
true. He didn't put it down, but I imagine, though you are, I think very skillfully, you answered my question by saying that, in a way, you're writing for the audience of the future. I think in your present capacity, you must be extremely interested in the present reader. And what I would say is, he may not have put it down, but the people on the right may put this down, may put this book down, and
there's there's not a damn thing I can do about it. What I hope is that some people on the right, and indeed I know this from the response I get to my column, some people on the right do read my column, some people on the right are sources for my column, that if people go to an open mind, they'll see that I have a particular story to tell. And it is a very particular story. It's not a book about so much how bad Bush is or how wrong this war is.
It is about that, too.
It is, but it's most of all about how the culture was manipulated and how they did it. It's kind of, to me it's a fascinating story. Others may disagree.
Because not everybody has heard it, it's quite an extraordinary way in which you tell it. Tell that story. How did they manage to manufacture reality in this fashion? Or as I've told you, one book that your book actually cites on page 2 or 3 of its narrative is a book that I've always adored, and I think it's particularly suited to mention him here. Daniel Boorstein, who used to be the Librarian of Congress,
right,
wrote a book which I invite everybody here to read, the exam will be next week, called The Image, a guide to, I don't know how you say this word in English,
pseudo-event.
I think you don't pronounce a P, so to pseudo-events in America. And pseudo-events is really what you are talking about.
Right, well,
in your book.
I grew up in Washington, D.C., not as part of a political family, in the period when he wrote that book, which was essentially the Kennedy era. And even as a kid, I could see, I remember enough of the Eisenhower era to have, even though I was very young, to notice a sea change when Kennedy came in, where theater amounted to much more. And indeed, famously, of course, in the 1960 presidential debates, people who watched the debates thought Kennedy had won, and people who listened thought Nixon had won, because Nixon may have had the better information or debating points, but Kennedy was such a charismatic figure. And I'd say if I've observed anything in all the years since that led up to the writing of this book, it's that idea that Boorstein first sort of put his finger on it after the birth of modern media has just exploded with each successive administration. For instance, in the Reagan years, obviously, you actually had a Hollywood actor at the center of the play, if you will, and techniques were developed by Michael Deaver that were quite brilliant. You know, there's the famous story of how Reagan, when he was cutting funding for a program involving senior citizens, the White House would have him cut the ribbon of a senior citizen center that day so that image that, you know, happy image would dominate the news and people wouldn't listen to what the reporter was saying, that, you know, they were actually cutting hundreds of millions of dollars out of programs that this image represented. So this has just been steadily improved upon with each administration. Some have done it better than others. All want to do it. You know, you look at Bill Clinton in 92, running for president by appearing on the Arsenio Hall show. Even Dan Quayle that year, you know, made a had a running debate with a fictional sitcom character, Murphy Brown, to up the sort of showbiz ante. With this administration, it's been remarkable.
How did they improve?
Well, nothing is left to chance. I mean, take for instance the now famous mission accomplished spectacle, which supposedly marked the end of major combat operations 3.5 years ago. Almost 3.5 years ago.
But who's counting?
But who's counting? Right. It wasn't just about the president standing under a banner saying mission accomplished. It was an entire day-long play worked out as assiduously as O'Neill worked out Morning Becomes Electra. It began, of course, with the president in a pilot's uniform, landing in a jet. It's a picture actually used on the cover, and reenacting what's essentially a scene out of the movie Top Gun. Now,
great movie.
Tom Cruise is in. Now, they're just to take this piece of it a second, it wasn't entirely coincidence that they lighted on this. There was an association between Jerry Bruckheimer, who produced Top Gun, and the Bush White House. In fact, during the early days of the war in Afghanistan, the Pentagon gave Bruckheimer permission and cooperation for a reality miniseries about the war in Afghanistan for the ABC primetime schedule. Ultimately, by the time it got on the air, it was a flop because people lost interest in Afghanistan. They thought we'd won the war. But even as the Pentagon was keeping the press out of that theater of war, Jerry Bruckheimer was invited in. So you see this reenactment of that scene. Now, the president was going to give a speech, the speech where he said that, you know, basically threw around the word victory and said major combat operations had ended. But he did not give the speech immediately after he got off the plane. They waited. They waited several hours. Why were they waiting? It wasn't just to put him in a business suit, although he got into a business suit. They were waiting for a particular time of day, which, as people in Hollywood know, is called the magic hour, that time around dusk, which cinematographers love, when the world looks great. It's when the hero and heroine kiss in a movie. It's that golden moment. They wanted that moment, and that's when he gave the speech under the banner. But that's not all they did. They got the troops, who had been more ordinarily dressed earlier when he landed the plane, now in color dress uniforms that they arranged by color around the president to add, you know, a little bit of pop to the image. Finally, they made sure that the speech was given in such a position, and the cameras were positioned to catch the speech, so that you would not see San Diego, which is 40 miles away. The whole point of the show was to sort of the president having victory at sea, if you will, a kind of inflation of his actual wartime service during Vietnam, a kind of single-handed...
That isn't hard, right?
Not hard, no. But he said, you know, when he got off and was meeting with the press, I can't remember the exact quote, it's certainly in the book, he said something like, you know, it's really great to be flying again, as if he had been, you know, running missions over Da Nang. It wouldn't do, given what they wanted to say, to have, you know, Marriott hotels in the background of the shot. So this was all incredibly carefully calibrated. Stuff like this doesn't happen by accident. It's planned. There were producers on the boat. The boat was delayed coming in to get this all together. And then, of course, when it all went south and it turned out major combat operations had not ended and there was an insurgency, the president famously sort of said, you know, we weren't so ingenious about this. It was the Navy thought up that banner. It just happened to be in the same font of every other administration sign. As John Stewart would say at the time, yes, it's those irrepressible Navy sign painters. They just can't stop themselves. But in the immediate aftermath of this, David Broder, the Dean of Washington Political Journalism, on Meet the Press, said, you know, this he has such command. They reviewed it the way I used to review, you know, Andrew Lloyd Webber. It was just, you know, he was, he had such authority in that uniform. I think it was Bob Novak who, on the same show, said, you know, could you imagine Joe Lieberman wearing a costume like that? And it worked. It worked for a while. And so all through, there have been versions of this. You know, some of them are relatively trivial. You know, the Washington Post discovered during the 2004 campaign that not only were the Ask the President pseudo town hall meetings stacked entirely with obviously supporters of the president, and that the people who asked the president were known to be supporters, but they were actually getting there a day earlier and having rehearsals and run-throughs and throwing panelists out if they didn't like the way, not because they're political, they were all favorable to the president, if it didn't work as well, you know, the same way that CBS might figure out casting Survivor.
I was going to ask you at one point this evening, but maybe I'll choose that moment for now, whether you were missing writing theater criticism. In a way,
when I never left it.
Yeah, in a way, in a way, as you describe it, this is what you're doing.
Yes. Well, you know, it's interesting. When I wrote my previous book before this, it was a childhood memoir. About growing up as a stage-struck kid in Dena, Washington. And the way I structured that book was that I found, when I was trying to go back to ages 7, 8, and 9, and I was telling this book from the perspective of that kid that I was then, that I could remember memories about my parents and about my childhood and my parents' divorce and all the rest of it entirely around shows. Like, I couldn't remember what we did, you know, for a holiday, but I could remember what we did the night we saw Bye Bye Birdie, you know, and and that's how I organized the book. Well, I suddenly discovered about halfway through writing this book that it was organized the same way, because you just go from one show to another, from shock and awe to, you know, the rescue of Jessica Lynch, to the Pat Tillman story. This stuff was constantly produced, and it's polished professional stuff. Some of it is more, you know, more successful, needless to say, than a lot of what I reviewed in the New York theater.
But I'm wondering to what extent you feel that maybe you're getting distracted by the smoke screen. In some way, we all know that the present administration is manipulating us. Most politicians are pretty good at doing that these days. But what are you teaching us that we didn't already know before you wrote this
book?
Well,
I think what I'm trying to do is atomize how it worked, because people didn't know it. They fell for it. We went to war against a country that didn't attack us. And
what about the weapons of mass destruction?
Well, there, that to me is one of the most interesting parts of it. What I could do that as a writer was, and I assiduously did this, I went through and pulled every single thing they did in the run-up to the war. Not just the most famous statements or Colin Powell appearing before the UN, which everyone knows about, but I literally went and traced, when was the first time they ever used the word nuclear?
And you should explain maybe to the audience the second part of the book.
Because it's really not so much the second part, but the appendix of the book, as a tool in writing the column a year and a half or 2 years ago, it was 2003, when the Valerie Plame Wilson case started to break, that case became a vehicle for us suddenly finding out all sorts of information about intelligence that the Bush administration knew about but did not share with us before the war. One example, maybe even a relatively minor example, is Joseph Wilson's trip to Niger. But there were many other things. And suddenly, as in journalism started to become more investigative again after, particularly since it had been had so frequently in the run-up to the war, stuff kept coming out. We'd find out that Kerbal, who was this Iraqi defector who was supposed to be the main source of them having the biological labs that Colin Powell talked about, was a known flake and a known fabricator and was just telling people what they wanted to hear. As each of these revelations came out, I started putting them on one side of a page and what they were saying in public on the other in the other column and in chronological order. And when I first did it, it was like 2.5 pages. In the book, it's an almost 80-page appendix because you find it's just fascinating to see, you know, Dick Cheney at a speech in the summer of 02, we know Saddam Hussein is going nuclear. And then you'll see, we now know that 3 weeks before that they saw this NIE or this CIA report or this report from the French government which knew about African transactions involving uranium and Saddam. And it's just amazing how effective, it was so effective. You say, what do people not know that I can tell them? I can't tell anyone, you know, some people what they don't know, but the fact is that this was so successfully done that by the time we went to war, half the country believed that the hijackers of 9/11 were Iraqis, when of course none of them were. And so I wanted to show how it happened. It's almost like taking a train wreck and doing a freeze frame and just watching it in slow-mo, if you will.
So how were we had?
We were had in several ways. First of all,
because very intelligent people were had, incredibly sophisticated.
Well, that's why it's such a great, that's why I think this is such an important story to tell. If just go back to your other point, if everyone knew this going in, then why did everyone sign on to what's probably going to be the biggest disaster in foreign policy in our lifetime? And why did smart people do it, including people, by the way, who were opposed to President Bush? That's a pretty damn effective mongering of propaganda. There are several things that happened. First of all, there was 9/11. I don't think this ever could have happened without September 11th. The country was, understandably, I was, traumatized. There was an understandable rallying effect for the president, which I wanted to believe in, and 90% of the country, almost 90% of the country supported President Bush after 9/11. Furthermore, despite a few voices on the far left, there was almost complete unanimity about going to Afghanistan and taking out the Taliban, or indeed any government who sheltered Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. And we did that, at least it seemed at the time, effectively. It was a fast war. It was a war with not a lot of casualties. It was very, very effective. It did everything it wanted to do, or so, again, obviously it's coming undone now, but at the time it was very effective, except unbeknownst to Americans, immediately we had lost Osama bin Laden in Tora Bora in December of 01. As the war was basically succeeding and ending. After the war, after 9/11, we know from Bob Woodward and others that while there was a neocon contingent that was pushing to, you know, for a war in Iraq, there are better targets in Iraq than there are in Afghanistan, Bush said no, he resisted it. Something happened in 02 that changed it. And there are many theories. I have mine in the book. George Packer wrote an excellent book about a supporter of the war, wrote an excellent book about his disillusionment with it, calls it the Rashomon of wars, because no one really knows. We all have our theories. But something happened, and it happened as poll numbers started to show waning support for war and terror. Now that we'd knocked out the Taliban, suddenly not 90% wanted a war, 52% wanted a war. Bush's approval ratings fell from 90 back into the mid to low 60s. It was an election year, 2002, midterm like this one. And that's when they started rolling out what Andy Card called this new product, the Iraq War. They created a sort of war organization, I don't know, a panel within the White House called WIG, the White House Iraq Group, that was convened in the summer of 2002, even as the president was saying, and others were saying, we've made no decision about this war. In fact, there was a group that not only included policy people like Scooter Libby, a big neocon operative, obviously, within the administration, but publicists, Karen Hughes, Mary Madeline, Karl Rove, who straddles both policy and politics. There were only eight or nine people in this group, and it was about selling the product. One of them was Andy Card, whose previous non-political job had been as a marketing PR guy for the big three auto companies in Detroit. So that's where they were coming from. We also, and again, by putting together this timeline and just trying to tell the story, events start to make sense when you put them in proximity to each other. For instance, to me, to this day, the most important leaked document of the war is the so-called Downing Street memo, where the head of British intelligence reported back to the Blair government, as I'm sure most of you know, that the facts didn't matter because the facts and intelligence were being fixed around the policy of going to war. Well, that
subject of Mark Danner's book.
Mark Danner's book, absolutely, which actually I wrote an introduction. Mark wrote the best explication of this. It's a book called published by the New York Review called The Secret Way to War. That memo was dated July 23, 02. That's exactly, more as far as we can tell from people who figured it out, when WIG started meeting. So that memo was entirely right. And yet, the pretense was being kept up publicly that a lot of people fell for. They were going to wait for the evidence, that we were going to, you know, wait for empirical evidence of WMDs. We were going to wait for Hans Blix. We were going to wait for facts. But there was never any intention. And this mindset continues to this day. I mean, right now, you know, Iraq is in chaos, and we're staying the course to victory, whatever that means. It's a very intricate process. You know, Bush gives off the sort of vibe of, you know, I don't know, a sort of shit kicking, you know, guy down at the ranch, easygoing guy. I think he's in fact very tightly wound, and I think that this is.
So shit kicking means exactly what?
No, you know, I mean, one of the guys down in Texas, you know, maybe not want to put too fine a point on it, but you can sort of imagine the image. Really think on a ranch, not that what he has is actually a ranch, but that's also manufactured. That's also a stage set.
And you talk about that, it's partly you create through a word, an image that conjures up in people the idea that he has a ranch.
There's a wonderful columnist who mainly writes about business for a very good magazine in Texas called the Texas Monthly, named Michael Ennis. And I met him, and he sort of walked me through it, and ultimately he wrote about it, and I quote him in the book. But he says, you know, the kind of house that the Bushes have in Crawford is a typical sort of eco-friendly house that rich people would build in his set, the way that people might build houses in the Hamptons in his set here. And it was built on the eve of his deciding to run for president, to give him this sort of, you know,
what he needed,
which is not for people to think that he was born in Connecticut, that his mother's from Greenwich, and that he went to Andover, Yale, and Harvard, all of which he did. But my point about Bush is that for all the sort of everyday guy vibe he gives off, he is stupid, and that this plot, and I don't say that in the sense of conspiracy, I mean literally in the sense of this narrative, this dramatic plot that took us to war, in which he was a willing participant and the star actor, was not something that was improvised on the spot. You know, it was an elaborate production.
talk a little bit about, if you would, what I think is really the theme, the probably the kernel of your book, which is the cultural context, as it were, that permitted this. I mean, much like Boerstein, which is the reason I think both of us like this book so much, spoke about a certain cultural context. His book was written in 1961, I believe. Right. Yours talks about the context which permitted this drama, which is why I think a theater critic could analyze this story so well.
Right. Well, the two reasons why I feel this story worked was, one, just go back to 9/11 a second. They never could have sold the war in Iraq without 9/11, because what happened, just to go back to the public buying it, we approved of the war in Afghanistan. It was a victory. Most people, I think, are trusting in this country, and there was no reason to ever believe that. I mean, there was some reason, obviously, but for most Americans, there was no reason to believe that this guy, having fought what they thought was a just and correct war, would now sort of go off on this detour. If there hadn't been 9/11 to set it up, I don't think the Iraq War ever could have been sold. The cultural piece of it is, when Boorstin wrote that book, it was indeed in the aftermath of the Kennedy-Nixon debates. Television was just coming into its own as a political vehicle. Now, all these years later, and particularly in the last 10 years, and particularly on the eve of George Bush becoming president, we have a much larger media apparatus. There's always been infotainment. You know, Edward R. Murrow, as we know from the recent George Clooney movie, reminds us, you know, didn't just go after Joe McCarthy, he interviewed Liberace. But we now have this 24/7 media swarm that has accelerated enormously. As recently as the first Gulf War, there was only one cable news network. Now there are three. In 1991, internet was not a mass medium. It became one towards the end of the Clinton years. There's this huge, hysterical morass of media that becomes almost the weather in this country and can be manipulated, particularly if you have an attack on America to precede it, and you have a press that's so into, a media industry that's so into signing on to anything the government wants, that NBC literally put its peacock logo in the corner of the screen in stars and stripes, even when it was affixed on stupid sitcoms. And that's the kind of culture that I think that the Bush administration was the first to really come to office having at their disposal, in the way that Kennedy once had the new idea of televised debates at his disposal.
But in a way, the 9/11 also played so much on that culture from the point of view of those who destroyed the towers. They used...
Absolutely, it's a very good point.
...in the most powerful way, the medium that Bush would then excel in using even better.
I think that's a great point. And look, even now, the culture is moving forward. There's an editor at Vanity Fair, David Friend, who's done a fantastic book about the sort of, it's called Watching the World Change, about the images of 9/11 photos. And one point that someone, like an editor of Perry Match, makes in that book is things have even changed in the past few years in such a way that people would have been sending photos by cell phone out of Ground Zero, and stuff would have been on YouTube or whatever. Things are changing so quickly. It's at once enthralling, and I know the subject of a number of your programs here.
Well, yesterday,
terrifying.
Yesterday it was amazing. We had a program here with Chris Anderson and Lawrence Lessig about Chris Anderson's book called
The Long Tail. Yeah.
Which is becoming longer by the day, really. It's the program was called Does Size Matter? And we had a very, very young audience with about 150 people in the audience with laptops on their knees, probably blogging. And actually, I'm wondering what you think of blogs.
It's very hard to generalize about blogs. It's like saying, you know, what do you think of newspapers in a way, because...
What do you think about newspapers?
They're in trouble. I think, you know, it's a great thing that anyone can have a platform and take a stand on anything and write their opinion about anything. I think that the issue for the news business is that for the most part, bloggers, at least in terms of like world news, don't provide new information. I mean, sometimes they do, or they do it on the margins. They're much better at fact-checking information in places like the New York Times. In the end, if we're going to find out what's going on in a war in Iraq, we actually have to have reporters that are probably very expensive and not bloggers who have training.
Tell me something about that. Do you, I know that I brought up the name of Mark Danner, who's someone I think we both admire quite a lot, and who's been here talking about torture and debating Mark Bowden and a few other people, Darius Rejali and Elaine Scarry and other people here. But I asked you earlier if you missed writing theater criticism, and you quickly answered by saying you've just continued doing it in a different way. But do you miss not being a reporter, actually going out to the places you write about?
No, I've never been that kind of reporter, quite frankly. I mean, I've done reporting in my career. I began my career as a reporter. And I don't miss theater criticism either. You know, I think of myself foremost as a writer and I'm someone who gets passionate about something and then gets passionate about something else, and it's not necessarily the case that I'll write this kind of column or a column like this indefinitely either, any more than I, and once I'm done with something, I'm sort of done with it. I loved, the first piece I wrote getting out of college, strangely enough, was a 10,000-word profile of Dan Ellsberg for Esquire magazine. I was a kid. I happened through a freak circumstance to meet him in what turned out to be the months before he would give the Pentagon Papers to the Times. This is years before I was actually at the Times. I didn't know anyone at the Times. And there was a lot of intrigue in doing that kind of reporting, particularly since he was on the lam and I had to go to a phone booth and the FBI was pursuing me, was pursuing my parents because I stupidly made some phone calls to him from home. I liked all that, but I also liked, reviewing Stephen Sondheim and August Wilson. I like what I'm doing now. I'm always looking for different experiences, and I'm much more peripatetic probably than most people in journalism.
I was asking the question also in terms of how you feel that you can rely solidly on sources.
Well, that's the issue about blogging. You don't have to go to journalism school. I didn't. You don't have to have, it's not like being a doctor. You don't have to have some certificate that says that you're a journalist. But you do have to have some basic reporting skills, which is weighing inevitably contradictory versions of events from a multiple of sources, whether the sources be people, officials, or different publications, or bloggers, or whatever, and trying to figure out what's real. And right now, that's harder than ever. And as we know from various scandals, both in regular journalism and in the internet journalism, people can just completely make something up. The girl who's now, I'm now going to forget, on YouTube, who had the entire, young America enthralled with her adventures, turned out to be an actress, and it was all fiction, but she bamboozled a lot of people, and that's sort of another version of what the Bush administration did in a different arena, but still a very powerful arena. So it's very complicated. Jason Blair got a lot of fictional stories into the New York Times through some very smart editors. So that is a skill. It's a learned skill. It can presumably be learned at journalism school, but it also has to be learned through experience. Sometimes. My first job was as a reporter on a weekly newspaper in Richmond. I started with some friends, and the whole paper was sort of oriented towards muckraking, and I learned on the job.
Frank, let me try to probe again with what I tried to start this conversation with, which is the readers on the left and the readers on the right, and your description. In the middle of the book, you have a not very flattering description, one might say, of Michael Moore and
or of John Kerry.
Or of John Kerry. I wonder which one was worse. But I mean, they sort of equal each other in terms of being quite negative, let's say. And in the case of Michael Moore, you are afraid in some way, or you describe the fact that he can be, he was used very easily and manipulated very easily by the right and by the Bush administration as the kind of enemy they always wanted to have. And the daily review of your book in the New York Times, I forget the reporter, the journalist who wrote that review, I think it was an extremely interesting review, said that you had given in some way to your foes the ability to, you had dissected the spectacle they use so that now
they could use it as a guidebook to doing it in the future.
Yes.
That's fine with me. I mean, what that doesn't bother me at all, because what I wanted to do was get into this story and tell it. And if someone wants to use what I wrote in a Machiavellian way and say, God, this is a great way to sell, you know, a war on Costa Rica or whatever, fine. I mean, I have a strong point of view to be sure, but I really wanted to tell this story and show the moving parts of it, explain how it happened and what made it click, and I think that's a very good point.
You see, I'm just so interested by this subject because it's come up again and again in the nine events we've had since 9/11. I've sort of completely given up on the notion of sleep. I feel I keep the night company at this point. But in any event, in many of these events, whether it's E.O. Wilson talking about his new book called The Creation, or whether it's Cameron Sinclair talking about sustainable architecture, whether it is Sam Harris, Letter to a Christian Nation, talking about atheism and a godless world. It was quite interesting, actually, today to see in the Washington Post that Sam Harris paid for his own advertising.
Oh, that's...
Which is...
You mean for his book?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
It is interesting.
I'm not that crazy.
No, I didn't imply anything, Frank, at all. I think your book doesn't need that aid, but it was interesting to see that, and I'm curious about that. It was big ads, you know, huge ads, including mentioning the event at the library, which caused some disarray at the door because we didn't quite have enough seats for that event. And then there is you talking to your audience, and the point I want to make very quickly, if I may, about 3 or 4 years ago, I remember in the Weekend Review, the very section where Sam Harris took out a full page ad, there was a graph of what the right reads and what the left reads, and the point of intersection, you know, like in mathematics when you used to have.
I remember that. I think
nearly nobody reads the same books, and there's no common.
I actually think it's changed. I think that, first of all, you've got to remember. A large majority of the country thinks this war was a mistake. This includes Democrats. I mean, I just know from my mail, I mean, from military people, things have changed. And a lot of people think the war was a mistake. A lot of people think that they were misled into the war. They think by huge numbers, by more than 40 points, I cite this in my column for Sunday, exactly what this NIE, this National Intelligence Estimate, said, that the Iraq War has encouraged terrorist threats against America.
Which is the subject of your column now.
Yeah, part of the subject of my column for Sunday. Every book that's written about this president or this war will, at the extremes, have people who are going to demean it in that polarized way. But there's more and more spillover between the two. Fiasco, Tom Ricks' superb book about how we screwed up the military stuff, that's being read by people on the left and the right, but it's much stronger in terms of its rhetoric about the war than my book is. Bob Woodward, who wrote two books that were basically sympathetic and supportive of for the Bush administration, and was praised by people like Mary Madeline as saying, this is history as it should be told, that's why we cooperated with them. Arnett today was being attacked by Tony Snow, and people on the left who attacked his other book will read this book now and decide, maybe decide he's a hero. We'll see. But the fact is that I think there is a kind of consensus now about this war, and people want to look back at it, and that's why so many interesting books are being written.
You know, the word you used, rhetoric, really made me think of something. Why are people on the left, generally speaking, and I'm making a generalization for the pleasure of an argument with you, which I'm trying to have, why are people on the left, generally speaking, a little more whiny and shrill sounding?
I don't believe it. In fact, I just wrote a piece for the New York Review of Books about Democrats complaining about people.
Peter Beinart and all of those.
Yeah, but I talk about that issue. If you go to a political blog on the left, you're going to see a lot of Bush-hating rhetoric. But if you go to one on the right, they're going to say the same things about Nancy Pelosi. They're a mirror image of each other, and you can't quantify it. There's certainly in talk radio many more on the right than there are on the left. I don't know what that means. It may say it's more about radio than the political divisions in the country. But I think that they're whiners on both sides. I don't buy.
I've had trouble here. Maybe in my programming, it might be a shortcoming on my part. We had a debate here on the Patriot Act, and we had Richard Posner and Jeffrey Stone. And I would say without. Quantifying intelligence here at all. I was quantifying really rhetoric. Richard Posner came out much stronger, and I would say the only example that I have, except for you present here today, is Mark Dana, who can take on Mark Bowden perfectly well and analyze.
Well, I don't know. Richard Posner and Jeffrey Stone are both very learned, good writers. I've never seen either of them as a debater. Maybe one won or lost that debate, but they're both top-notch public intellectuals.
That's why I brought them.
But I don't know what that has to do with your point about the left being shrill. Jeffrey Stone's book about freedom of speech during wartime in America is a classic. He's a professor at the University of Chicago. Yeah. It's the best thing ever written on the subject. It's an academic tome. It's hardly a shrill blogging polemic. I think that, look, I wrote a column a couple of weeks ago about 9/11 where I made a joke about conspiracy theorists, mainly on the left, who believe that, the buildings imploded and it was all, the planes had nothing to do with, there's a whole, and I've gotten, tons of angry emails and so on. But I get the same thing from people on the right about something else I write.
In the New York Times Book Review, Jen Senior just wrote a review of Sidney Blumenthal and Lewis Lapham. I don't know if you saw that piece. And she got a lot of criticism because she was accusing the left of not having a sense of humor.
Well, first of all, I don't consider myself a person of the left. I'm not going to defend everyone on the left. And I have to say, everything you're saying goes against my grain as a writer. I don't believe in these kinds of sweeping generalities. I believe in very, very specific writing. The book I wrote, and I hope everything I've written, whether people like it or hate it, very, very specific, very fact-based, not making wild sweeping generalizations
Let me ask a very specific question then. On this very stage, I asked the editor of The New Yorker, David Remnick, at the end of an interview where we're coming to now, whether he thought that Bush had lied to the country.
Well, I have an answer to that. I set out to, that's one of several questions I wanted to answer in this book, and not in the way of saying, oh, of course Bush lied, people died, not in terms of leftist rhetoric, but by actually looking at the evidence empirically, and that was one of the points of doing this very intricate timeline. And here's what I learned, and it's all laid out in the book with citations so people can decide for themselves whether there's something to my argument or not. There was indeed a lot of wrong intelligence about Iraq and about Saddam Hussein and his WMDs. And as the Bush administration is fond of saying, Democrats saw that same intelligence and endorsed it. Europeans saw it and endorsed it. True. There was also a lot of right intelligence. What I discovered was, without exception, the intelligence that turned out to be wrong was what they highlighted, and the intelligence that was right was what was not in the speeches, not in the documents, not in the white paper given to Congress and the public before the war. It's so consistent, it's unbelievable. And one reason why I was suspicious about the war going in, even before the facts were, we didn't know a lot of the facts then, was that they kept hammering on nuclear. They kept using this nuclear, the word nuclear, uranium.
They pronounce it differently,
though. Yes, they do. The smoking gun that will be a mushroom cloud. Everyone knew that was the weakest evidence. And why did they hit that so hard? That's much scarier than sarin gas. People sort of have vague idea what it is, but so what I conclude in the book about whether they lied or not is, in the end, it may be a distinction without a difference. Either they intentionally just cherry-picked the stuff that was false, you know, Mohammed Atta meeting with Saddam intelligence agents in Prague before 9/11, or they were so convinced by their own idée fixe about having this war that they couldn't tell the difference. They fell for their own propaganda. So one way or the other, it's quite clear they only told us the things that were false and didn't tell us the things that were true, even when they knew they were true at the time. And so history is going to have to judge whether they were self-blinded or whether they deliberately set out to lie.
I remember David Remnick saying something to the effect, if by lie you mean the withholding of information, and then he went on, of course.
But it's not just the withholding of information. As I show in this timeline, and as many of you know from reading news accounts, I've just tried to collect it all together, they were constantly receiving actual documents and intelligence, including from allies, saying there's nothing to the aluminum tubes. There's nothing to that he couldn't. The French government, several times, its intelligence agency warned the White House that Saddam, forget about Joe Wilson, that Saddam Hussein could not have been getting uranium in Niger
because it's their
former colony, yeah, and they know all the people who deal with uranium. That's what they knew. We're not talking about, you know, United States. We're talking about a very small country where they knew all the players in that business. It's not something you can just do in a garage. The Germans told the known fabricate. It was time after time they kept this to themselves and or deliberately said things that they had been told by good authorities wouldn't hold up.
Before we conclude, what does Frank Rich read for pleasure or do for pleasure?
Do for pleasure? I go to the theater. I like to read fiction.
What are you reading?
Well, right now I'm mainly reading about Iraq, which is not fiction. But, you know, I like Murakami. I mean, the best I'm looking forward to, but haven't read yet, the Claire Massoud book. The best novel I've read in the past year is the last Ishiguro novel, Never Let Me Go. Has anyone read it? It's just spellbinding. Anyway, I read, you know, on vacation I read A Passage to India, which I turned out to be, which I hadn't read in years, and which, like everything these days, seems alarmingly relevant. I went to Madama Butterfly the other night at the Met. Suddenly, you see it through a new lens as a result of the events of the past few years.
I would like, as a coda, just to give people the flavor of this book and also how lyrical it is in some ways, have you read 2.5 paragraphs,
okay,
if you don't mind.
I don't mind.
Which is the very end of the book. It's a moderately hopeful ending.
Moderately hopeful, I like that.
Yeah, moderately hopeful. It's not fully hopeful. I'm not sure it's a call to action, but It's a call.
All right, sure.
And let me say, just before Frank starts to read, that after this, there'll be a Q&A. In my decade of experience of doing this, I've realized that questions can be asked in about 32 seconds. So rather ask questions than make long comments. There are two mics on each side of the auditorium. We ask you to go there and to ask your question. And after that, Frank has agreed to sign some books, but something quite special will happen today. Between the end of the program and the signing of the books, Frank is closing a column, so he needs to quickly call the paper to do some fact-checking, what bloggers don't always do. So now it's your turn.
Just not that grand, just checking with the copy desk. So from here, what if those?
From here to the end.
Okay. Yeah, this is the end of, it's not strictly the end of the book, but it's the end of an epilogue, sort of. What if those thousands of tactical errors belatedly conceded by Condoleezza Rice had not been made? I should say, this is, you know, a few months ago she said that they had made many tactical errors in the war.
Thousands of them.
The story might not have turned out all that differently. The what if that matters most is not what if the Iraqi army had not been disbanded, but what if the Bush administration had told the truth? What if it had not hyped the intelligence and tried to argue the case for regime change in Iraq on its merits, whether geopolitical or humanitarian? What if it had conceded early on that it miscalculated the post-Saddam aftermath in Iraq? What if it had then invited Americans and their elected representatives to have a candid debate about the options, costs, sacrifices, and possible benefits ahead? What if a government that so fervently espoused democracy for the world had had a commensurate faith in democracy at home? These questions, simple and even naive as they may be, matter more than all the tactical questions combined. That they are so rarely asked in the wake of this debacle is a measure of just how much the very idea of truth is an afterthought and an irrelevancy in a culture where the best story wins. While the Bush administration's toboggan ride into Iraq was facilitated by an easily cowed press and a timid and often disingenuous political opposition, the news culture that predated both 9/11 and this presidency also played a big role. It was in the mid-1990s that the American electronic news media jumped the shark. That's when CNN was joined by even more boisterous rival 24/7 cable networks, when the internet became a mass medium, and when television news operations, by far the main source of news for Americans, were gobbled up by entertainment giants such as Disney, Viacom, and Time Warner. While there had always been a strong entertainment component to TV news, that packaging was now omnipresent, shaping the coverage of stories from Washington scandals to Wall Street bubbles to child abductions to war, and around the clock, not just on the evening news, the morning shows, and the occasional network news magazine. In this new mediathon environment, drama counted more than judicious journalism. Clear-cut evildoers and patriots were prized over ambiguous characters who didn't wear either black or white hats. Once definable distinctions between truth and fiction were blurred more than ever before as reality was redefined in news and primetime entertainment alike. The Bush White House certainly did not invent this culture. It has been years in the making and it is bipartisan. But this administration was the first to take office after it was fully online and was brilliant at exploiting it to serve its own selfish reality remaking ends. The TV maw needs to be fed 24/7, and Bush's producers supplied a nonstop progression of compelling shows to do so. If this White House knew anything, it knew how to roll out a slick product by the yard. History tells us that politics is cyclical in America, and the Bush cycle may well be in its last throes. But the culture in which it thrives still rides high, waiting to be exploited by another master manipulator from either political party if Americans don't start to take it back.
Thank you. So we'll start with the left. I think that's quite appropriate. And then we'll go to the right afterwards.
I'd like to know what Mr. Rich's opinion was of the New York Times TV reviewer Alessandra Stanley's review of The Path to 9/11, which she felt was even-handed, where she twisted the conclusions of the 9/11 Commission and said that Clinton, not Bush, was to blame for 9/11. I'd like to know what your opinion of that very controversial review was.
I'm a former critic, and I feel she has a right to say whatever she wants to say, and she's entitled to her opinion.
But the Times had to run a correction the next day. Is that the kind of reporter should we be working for the New York Times? Somebody who gets their facts wrong?
You're not going to get me to start. I don't feel that she deserves criticism for having a strong opinion.
This has to do with an item that has kind of lingered and not been referred to at all, it seems, since it first happened. We were bidding on the oil fields near the Persian Gulf when Argentina got them. And it seems that at that time, when Argentina got them, we left Afghanistan and went to Iraq, and Halliburton was born, etc. Do you think that there is a valid sequence in that?
I don't know enough to know.
You
obviously know more about this than I do.
It was from public media. It was twice on television, and then they took it off. And no one has referred to it, and yet it seems to be a prime
If I had
strength.
Seen it, I would have a comment, but I'm a real believer in not having opinions about things I don't know about.
Wow.
And I did
okay.
not follow the narrative of Argentina in the war in Iraq. I'm sorry.
Okay.
What's your take on the Chris Wallace-Bill Clinton interview?
On the Chris Wallace-Bill Clinton interview?
Yeah.
You know, I still haven't quite figured it out. I think that, as people who know Clinton well said, this was only just 40% of the full temper. It's pretty amazing. It was satisfying for everybody. It was satisfying for people who hate Clinton, and it was satisfying for people who hate Fox News. And in that sense, I always wrote a column about it, but I didn't this week. You know, I was going to say it's like the Janet Jackson moment. People who love to deplore indecency just were in heaven, you know, in pig heaven. And people who like to wallow in indecency were in pig heaven, too. Beyond that, you know, the substance, in terms of the substance, Clinton had a point, had two points. One is that, of course, they don't ask these tough questions of Republican people in the administration. Not that Chris Wallace's questions were so tough to Clinton either, but they were a little bit more aggressive, I guess. And the other point is that he did fail. He didn't do enough. He may have done it more haphazardly than he admitted, but he did do more about Al-Qaeda than the Bush administration did in its 8 months before 9/11, because they did absolutely nothing. And, you know, that's on the record. What interested me most, and actually I write about this in part in my column on Sunday, is that Condoleezza Rice, instead of just letting, you know, grumpy old middle-aged men go at each other, had to rush to defend her own honor and said, and made these outrageous claims about what they were doing in 01, which just are not true. In fact, in the new Woodward book, there's an anecdote of George Tenet, I think, in July, rushing into her office and, you know, saying, we gotta worry about Al-Qaeda, and she blew him off. So why she would step into it when she didn't really have to is, I found, fascinating as a subject.
My question is based on your having grown up in Washington, D.C. There are about 600,000 Americans who live there who pay taxes and die in wars, but don't have senators who can vote for them. And I've always been mystified how people who live in the district accept that, and can it ever be changed?
You hit a subject near and dear to my heart. Mm. At the height of white flight in Washington in the late 50s, my parents moved from Montgomery County into the district. And I went to the public school system
in Washington, which had lower per capita spending per student than Mississippi or West Virginia, because it was essentially a black city and a black school system. I went to the last high school that was majority white. They had so little money, it was great at the time, we would have exams canceled because they didn't have the money to pay for composition paper for us to take the exams on. You know, AP American History was an extra lunch hour, and there was so much fear of in the city, I should explain, for those of you who don't know District of Columbia history, the city then was run by something called the House District Committee, which were white, racist, Democratic in those times, congressmen, who just gave no money to this black city. And the whole home rule, as a kid, I thought, what? I'm in the nation's capital. I'm surrounded by all these buildings. And there was not even a vote for president then. There was nothing. There wasn't even the mayor. There was absolutely nothing. There wasn't the fake congressperson. So in senior year of high school, I was running my school paper, the Woodrow Wilson Beacon, and with a friend of mine who was another editor there, we ran an editorial in favor of home rule for the District of Columbia. And it was banned by our journalism teacher and this principal. And so we started an underground paper, told the Washington Post, ended up on the front page of the city section of the Washington Post, told every television station, radio station, and that began sort of my journalism career. The friend, another white Jewish kid going to public schools in Washington at the time, my friend who I did this with, Jeremy Pixar, would grow up to be the Oscar-nominated co-screenwriter of Bullworth. To this day, my father, who was a businessman in Washington and is now in his mid-80s, is, you know, it's like beating your head against the wall, but is involved with DC Vote, the organization that still lobbies to get, you know, representation, to go with the taxation. I think that what I saw as a kid growing up in Washington, living in a de facto segregated city that purported to stand for everything great in our civic values, our democratic values, to see the hypocrisy on that, there's no question, had enormous influence on my worldview. And also my view about, that sort of turns up even in this book about the Bush administration, or my view about the theater. I was always very conscious of the fake show that was presented, that you'd go on tour of Mount Vernon, or you'd go, you know, with school groups, we'd go to the Washington Monument and the White House and the Capitol, and the reality that in this city, Americans, black Americans, were treated as second-class citizens. They didn't have fundamental rights guaranteed in our Constitution. And everyone was sort of, in those days, pretending as if it wasn't happening. And I think it always made me want to, therefore, look behind the facade of anything the government does, Democrat, Republican, liberal, conservative, whatever, because often what you see is not what you're getting.
Yes, I wonder if you could share with us your opinion or evaluation of the news coverage we're getting about Iran now.
I've been asked this before, and I don't have a really handy answer. I think that the press is much chastened by what went on in the run-up to Iraq, and I think that, you know, that people are making a serious effort to not be bamboozled again. And we can't automatically assume, by the way, that we are being bamboozled and it's exactly the same story. But I do think that people are working the story very hard. It's been a very brutal time for the news business. People are upset, you know, in my business are upset about it. A lot of people feel they failed. So I think there's even more of an incentive to not make the mistake again, which doesn't mean necessarily that they're not building nuclear weapons. We don't know. You know, people are trying to find out and not taking any governments, whether the American or the Iranian governments, word for what's happening.
Yeah, you've been immersed with all these characters as if, you know, the way you were talking about how you made it be more of a play than that. I'm wondering about the psychology of everybody that you've met or thought about. Is there some sort of collective psychosis going on? I mean, what makes somebody want to pursue a position of leadership and care so little about the truth or about the people or the human beings that they govern?
You know, that's probably an answer, a question for like Eric Erickson, you know, not me. Were he around? I think that, you know, I would say my feeling about Washington, which I've spent a lot of time in, obviously, but sort of on the outside looking in, you know, the way I grew up in Washington is like growing up in Beverly Hills and not being in the movie business, you know, which gave me an interesting, I feel, perspective on it. Or I feel that power is a very, very powerful drug for a lot of people. And the interesting one of the interesting things to me about George W. Bush is that I don't think he was particularly ideological. I don't think he was a neocon. We know from his public statements in the campaign against Gore and even in his early days in the White House, he had a foreign policy that was very, as he said, humble, unambitious. He wanted to build the Star Wars missile shield that had been left over from the Reagan era. But I think he liked the idea of winning. I think he liked the idea of being in power. I think that that is, as I guess Kissinger said, a tremendous aphrodisiac. And once people get power, they want to do anything to preserve it, by and large. Very few people like to give up power. And so they cut a lot of corners. And I think they saw this war in Iraq as, you know, like when the Reagan administration went into Grenada. Slam dunk, not very costly in terms of money or blood. That's how they planned it. They had, you know, they had an administrator, Jay Garner. They were going to just go in and go out. There were no plans for nation building. They're going to draw down troops to 30,000 that year. So they sort of, I think they fell in love with their own idea and then it's going astray. And when people lie or cut corner on truth or put on these kind of propaganda displays, I think it's most of all about holding on to power.
Well, how can somebody be involved with...
Sorry, we'll take a couple more questions, please.
Yes, thanks a lot for your writing.
Thank you.
And I'm just wondering if you have a lot of readers under 40, because, you know, by the looks of this audience, it makes me...